We have reached a verdict already. We all just kind of looked at each other and nodded. We find the defendant guilty of charges.
Weight 105?
Yeah,
in your bra.
Your Honor, I object.
You would.
Bastard!
Hey! Quiet!
Whether it's race judicata or stare decisis, there is no basis for imposing some draconian policy with regard to bail, nunc pro tunc.
Your Honor, the defense is now just making up words.
We came into your trial. Oh, look how cute. There's like a judge and everything. And jury people.
Vote for Al!
Ladies.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 207. I am Thomas Smith. That over there is the man with the hardest friggin' job in the world right now. Andrew, how does one plan a show right now? I don't understand.
So here's what you do. You painfully assemble a whiteboard. You start working on it Wednesday night after the Opening Arguments fantasy football draft. So at about, 9:30, you work on that all night. And then at 15 minutes before the record, you trash that entire thing because the New York Times via Cory Booker has just released a series of emails from Brett Kavanaugh. So, so that's how you do it.
Wow. What a news day. What a news week. Oh, this is going to be tough. So inevitably, we can't get to everything, especially because we have 30 minutes of baseball law first, because that's how Andrew does it. No, not really. But wow, we better get right to it because there is so much to talk
about.
He
who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
And by that, I mean, let's get to the first segment involving listeners' feedback.
Hey, you got to listen to the whole show. Yeah,
exactly. Andrew cannot help but tease a little bit. We're going to talk about a couple quick things first before we get to Kavanaugh.
I did. I initially had Kavanaugh, because we usually do Yodel Mountain in the C segment. So I at least moved it up to the main segment. So our listeners only have, a couple of things of listener feedback to get through. I want to start off with, we've obviously gotten a lot of emails on episode 205 with Andrew Seidel involving the Pennsylvania grand jury report from the Catholic Church. I want to talk about that in more depth on Tuesday's episode, in episode 208. But I will say this, okay? We do this show. This is a challenging show. We get emails from folks who have, particular causes and interests. And I get that if you are a Catholic, like many of my friends and colleagues, like many of your family, Thomas, that was a tough episode. There is one comment that we got that I want to clarify, because when you look at the transcript, I think it came out in a different manner than Andrew Seidel intended. And so we got a listener comment that said, that quoted Andrew saying, "You cannot be a thoughtful, compassionate, empathetic human being and be a Catholic at the same time." Now, that comment came in the discussion of the use of Catholic Church funds from tithing, right? It absolutely took place in that larger context. And that's what I think Andrew meant by the phrase at the same time, right? Like he meant to say, you should be feeling, I think he meant to say, and certainly, let me not put words in Andrew's mouth. He's been on the show. He can, speak for himself. I interpreted that sentence, and I believe you, you jump in here too, Thomas. I interpreted that sentence as there is a level of cognitive dissonance, and we want you to think long and hard if you are sitting in the Catholic Church and putting money in the collection plate, that should cause you some heartache. That should cause you some cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, I chime in, but I don't. Well, I'll turn it into a scathing atheist style rant if I do, I'm sure, because I'm just blown away that after all the discussion of the just gut wrenching, horrendous stuff going on in the Catholic Church, there could be people who would listen to the episode and then hear that Andrew Seidel might have said something mean to Catholics. And that's the takeaway that they're more concerned about. They're more concerned with their Catholic identity in quitting listening to the show because someone might have minorly offended their Catholic identity than they are quitting the entire Catholic Church because of literal child rape and torment and all that. I'm just blown away by that. And sure, I also, in the grand scheme of things, it's such a minor thing. But sure, let's clarify. You know, like, obviously my family is Catholic, so... Do you really think we were sitting up here saying, like, all Catholics are evil people? That this would be the level of concern. Yes, okay, you can be a Catholic and a good person. But what I think we all meant to say, and, you know, who knows about Andrew Seidel, but what I was thinking, too, was I don't think you should support the Catholic Church. If you're a Catholic, fine, have your belief system, whatever. Just please don't give money to the church, because clearly that money is directly... contributing toward covering up sex crimes of children. It's horrendous. So that's some of what I think on the issue.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's why I wanted to lead off. I mean, I do think that statement, I do think that we interpreted it differently than it came out. But it's why I wanted to lead off with, we intend for this to be a challenging show, right? I have a client who is a friend of mine who is a gun instructor, right? And he listens to the show. And every time we do an episode on guns, right? You know, I meet up with him on Friday and I get a little bit of a side eye. We have listeners who are, libertarians. We have listeners who are Jill Stein voters, right? Like, this, the show's meant to be a challenging show. And I don't want to back down from that. And that's why I said that first. But I do think it was important to clarify in that context. And we are, the point of all of that is to reach out. And if there are folks who want to, you know, reform from the inside, you know, yeah, we welcome you on our side. Right. So, okay. We're going to talk more about some of the specifics, on Tuesday, but we got some Kavanaugh to get to. So,
all right. Yeah. Let's move on. We got a good listener question here that I think will be important to talk about. Anders from Scandinavia asks, I've been considering becoming a patron supporter for a while. I heard in the latest episode that you are donating Patreon proceeds to certain political causes. I'm not a U.S. citizen nor a resident of the U.S. I just like the show as I learn a lot from it. I would imagine that I'm not allowed to donate to political causes in the U.S. So what happens then?
So I suspected that Thomas was about to render 100% correct legal advice here, which is we are donating in our names individually to swing left. And so we are taking that out of the Patreon proceeds. That's 100% legal. So we got this question from a bunch of folks. Look, you know, if you don't want to donate money to a show that supports liberal cause, you probably, you know, don't want to be a patron anyway.
Lot Awful Movies. Yeah. That's the trap.
That's true. Think about it. Look, think about your patronage. If you're Republican, if you're conservative, if you're libertarian, think about your patronage the same way Thomas thinks about when he goes into In-N-Out Burger or I go into Chick-fil-A, right? Oh, like, man. It's just balancing out the karma of the universe.
I used to have such moral superiority by being able to say I've never even been to a Chick-fil-A, but now that In-N-Out is implicated, okay, I'm abandoning all that.
I haven't been in a year. I wish I could say it was for moral reasons, right? But their chicken biscuit breakfast is just, it's the best fast food thing ever invented. But anyway, enough on that. So I had a bunch of folks email us. There are no election law violations. There's no problem. There's nothing wrong.
Well, and by the way, incidentally, for Swing Left, we can't even donate as opening arguments legally.
Correct.
We have to donate. We're just individuals using, you know, essentially our job income in a certain way. That's really all it is. But we just wanted to let people know, so that might encourage other people to donate as well, because Well, as we'll hear from the Kavanaugh stuff today, it would be a lot. We would all be a lot better off if Democrats had control of Congress.
Yes.
All right. And then finally, William Dunn suggests that 3D guns could not be easily printed. And quote, the fear surrounding 3D printing in recent years is absolutely ridiculous and is nothing but hyperbole from those who don't understand the technology. What do you think about that,
so,
Andrew?
Yeah, I take that very, very seriously. And I have another really close friend and a client and somebody who is to the right of me politically, but I somebody I trust who is an engineer in materials fabrication, right? So his business is prototyping using 3D printers. And when I asked him this question, he was like, well, it depends on which 3D printer you're using. And instantly, like I was 30 seconds in and I was like, okay, I'm totally lost with the technology here. So I am having him evaluate this claim. I am not capable of evaluating the claim. And I should mention, William sent us a lengthy email with a lot of claims about how the Liberator files operate and everything else. I want to get to the bottom of that, right? At its core, in my mind, the salient question is not how reliable is this weapon as a military weapon, right? Like, we agree that it's not, right? This is a plastic, what they used to call Saturday night specials, right? Like, this is an El Cheapo gun that's probably going to blow up in some kid's hands. The question is, it has been represented that, no, you kids couldn't print this, couldn't make this on their school printer or home printer or something like that. And I want to get to the bottom of that. So
yeah, no, it's absolutely nothing we should be concerned with as long as technology always stays exactly the same and doesn't advance in any way. Then we should not be concerned at all. No, I think I mentioned this a few times because I had seen on Twitter like, oh, some experts saying like this is very infeasible kind of thing. And my understanding is you need like an industrial strength, 3D printer right now to be able to do it in any way that is reliable. But, how long is that going to be true? A year, 2 years? Like it doesn't make it less of an issue to talk about legally. And I don't know, I would find it hard to believe that such a big deal would have been made about this if there were absolutely no danger to it. I mean,
we used as the show graphic, right, an illustration of someone having printed the gun. And again, my understanding as distinctly not an expert, which is why I'm going to an expert to find out, is that the lesser quality and lesser quality is the wrong way to think about it, right? It's just they're different kinds of technologies, right? And so my understanding is that when you use a different kind of plastic, that it makes it more brittle, more likely to explode, more likely to harm the user. That, in my mind, does not reduce the danger, right? Like the danger, as we've always said, is kid goes to school and prints this gun and other things too, right? But all of the other stuff about like, well, hobbyists can build a gun out of metal tubing and like, that's not, in my mind, that's targeting a different area. My question is this proliferating in a way that is dangerous? That is, quite frankly, what Cody Wilson, right, the guy who started Defense Distribute, what he represented, right? Like his claims about his own file were, I want this to get out there because that's going to make gun control impossible because anybody can just download the plans and print off a gun. And so, ha, 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 we won't have any Newtown style, calls for government regulation. So, part of that is evaluating his central claim. So anyway, we're going to evaluate all that.
All right. Well, with that somewhat defensive posture out of the way from us here at Opening Arguments, let's get to Kavanaugh. Oh, boy. I wanted to actually do, Andrew, I was going to script out a skit, which was, you ask me, I'll be Kavanaugh, and you ask me about the conversation I had with, I can't remember the name of the law firm, but it had a Torres in there, so I don't know if you're involved in it, but did you see?
I was not.
Did you see the Kamala Harris one?
Yeah.
But the problem is it would just be 10 minutes of me playing as dumb as humanly possible. And I don't think that would play that well on the podcast. So, but just pretend we did that, I guess.
Judge Kavanaugh, would you overrule Roe v. Wade if you were appointed to the Supreme Court?
Now, if I were to hazard a guess based on the other answers I've seen from Kavanaugh, he would be like, describe that again. Sorry. And then just waste 5 minutes. Oh, sorry, Senator Kamala Harris. Your 5 minutes is up because the stupidest man on earth apparently is sitting in that chair. And he just said, Mueller investigator? Investigation? It's embarrassingly. That's my new. By the way, we've argued about how to get rid of these justices. Like, what's the best way to pack the courts? My new preferred method now is impeachment on the grounds that you're the stupidest man in the universe. If you turn, like, when you ask Kavanaugh whether or not he spoke to someone at a law firm about the Mueller investigation, his answer is, or no, at first she asked him, have you spoken to anybody about the Mueller investigation? He says, oh, no. Well, maybe. Well, first he asked, like, define that for 4 hours. And then he's like, well, no, not really. And then she says, what about at this law firm? Hinting at the fact that she probably has an email or no, you know, something specific.
Right.
And his answer is no, he hasn't spoken to anybody about it, but he can't answer the law firm thing because he doesn't know who's at the law firm. So both no, I haven't spoken to anybody except fellow judges, depending on who's in the law firm, then maybe I have spoken to somebody about it. It's the most annoying 5 minutes or 7 minutes I've ever watched. So that's what I have to contribute to Kavanaugh. Okay, Andrew Torres, you take your turn.
Yeah, no, that was good. Look, So two things. Number one, the standard answer, and Kavanaugh has parroted this multiple times in the hearings, that has been developed since Clarence Thomas was appointed to the Supreme Court, has been for judges to say, Senator, it would be inappropriate for me to comment on a matter that might come before the Supreme Court, which is, of course, right. The stupidest possible answer you can give. This is a both sides do it. Right. But we are much.
We've
poorer.
All decided that this is how we're going to do this, that when we get interview these justices in front of the Senate, we don't want any actual answers. Like, we've all just agreed. Yeah. Nobody wants an answer that will have any impact on decision making at all. Right. Yeah. You're here to become a Supreme Court justice. So maybe I'll ask you a question about how you might rule as a Supreme Court judge. No, I can't answer that. Are you kidding me? Ask me about my kids. I carpool my kids. Any baseball coach questions?
My favorite successful attempt to evade an effort to defuse that sort of question was when Clarence Thomas was asked, I believe by Joe Biden, Judge Thomas, you were in law school when Roe v. Wade was decided. Did you ever chat about it in law school? Did you ever talk to anybody? What was your impression?
And no, I was too busy sexually harassing women. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. His answer honestly was, Senator, I don't recall ever having discussed Roe v. Wade in law school. I remember us discussing Griswold versus Connecticut, which is the contraception case. But no, I don't think, you know, he literally gave the fake answer that you gave a couple of minutes ago.
Yeah.
Although in the case of Clarence Thomas, it was somewhat believable. I kind of undercut the narrative. Brett Kavanaugh is not a dumb guy, right? Like, that's what makes it funny here. He is unbelievably intelligent, eminently qualified from an intellectual standpoint to serve on the Supreme Court. And so his feigning of incompetence is patently transparent. But I have what I was prepared to do today was to say, yeah, Kavanaugh hearings are going to end this week and he's going to be appointed. He's going to be confirmed. There's nothing we can do about it. I still wouldn't put a high likelihood on this, but 10 minutes before we went to press, the New York Times uncovered, Senator Cory Booker leaked to the New York Times certain emails that Brett Kavanaugh wrote while he was in the Bush White House. And in my view, these are really, really corroborative emails for the point that you and I have been making about Brett Kavanaugh from the very beginning, right? Which is, this is not a neutral judge who just calls balls and strikes like he sees them. This is a Republican Party activist who is intent on transforming the Supreme Court. And these documents underscore that. And I think, look, okay, so politically, right, the game is to see if you can get Susan Collins to vote no, and then see if you can get someone else to abstain, right? Because right now, the composition of the Senate is 51-49 with, I'm not sure when John Kyle, who has been appointed to fill out McCain's term in Arizona, I don't know when he physically arrives in Washington, D.C. But it'll be, you know, in a day or two. And obviously, if it's just a 50-50 tie, then you have, you know, Mike Pence can cast the tie-breaking vote as vice president. So what you need is some way to turn that into 50-49. So that is, get a Kyle or a Murkowski to vote present or abstain, and get Susan Collins to flip on the grounds that she is ostensibly pro-choice and has said, I have been convinced that Brett Kavanaugh is not going to immediately overturn Roe v. Wade the second he is appointed, which of course he will do. So in light of that, these are the emails that the New York Times has released. We're going to link them in the show notes, and I want to parse through them, but I want to give you some background because it's not immediately apparent, particularly the longer one, when you are reading through them, exactly what you're reading and who's talking about what, because it's, you know, it's an extended embedded chain.
Oh, right.
So let's start with the easy one first, because I think this helps to underscore Brett Kavanaugh, who he is, which is exactly who opening arguments has been telling you he is, a political partisan hack who will use his Republican right-leaning politics to legislate and rule from the bench for right-wing causes the second he is sworn in. And I don't know why every Democrat is not lining up behind that as the story of why you oppose Kavanaugh. All this other stuff.
I don't know, but isn't that, don't we just live in a world where, ignore all the Garland stuff, ignore the investigations, don't we live in a world where Trump gets to appoint the biggest Republican hack and then, you know, ostensibly we, if we ever get power and they let us, we get to appoint a liberal justice, and that's kind of how the system works, you know, that may, I guess I don't understand why that's that compelling.
Because all of these Republican senators in swing states have come out and said, I support Kavanaugh because I'm convinced that he's going to be fair and neutral in applying the law. Right. So it is, it's part of what undercuts the Republican narrative regarding originalism. Right. Like, remember that whole, I calls them like I sees them, balls and strikes, I'm the umpire, not, you know, like that's part of the entire Republican narrative about who their judges are. The whole thing is a lie, but it is a transparent lie when it comes to Neil Gorsuch, and it is a transparent lie when it comes to Brett Kavanaugh. And again, you don't, right, you know, all you need to do is convince Republican senators in swing states that they don't have this fig leaf anymore, that they are voting for Trump's hack to come on and engage in egregious right-wing Republican partisanship from the bench. I think that's the best argument. Maybe I'm wrong politically, but certainly I think everything, look,
well,
you know, we
at
are
the
not
risk of
have,
derailing you and yep. getting complaints about interrupting you. Yep. I think the best for me to, as just layperson over here, layperson Democrat, I don't know why we don't just say, oh, Merrick Garland was stolen. Two arguments. A, Merrick Garland's seat was stolen, so no Democrat is ever voting yes for justice until that's rectified. And then B, also on top of that, the president is under major serious investigation for crimes involved in essentially stealing the election by misrepresenting and violating campaign finance law and all that stuff. to deprive the public of the information they needed to make their decision in the voting box. So therefore, no justices. Don't even make it about Kavanaugh. It has nothing to do with Kavanaugh, because I don't even think we can win that fight, because I think it's the country's understanding, to once again play the layperson, I think it's our understanding that, yeah, Trump gets to appoint whatever crappy right-wing guy, and then we get what they would think is a crappy left-wing person next. So that's my strategy idea, but, I'm not the lawyer on this show.
Well, no, look, we're, as a matter of political strategy, right, you have every right to that opinion. I would say and I have mentioned those arguments before. I think those are the arguments that hold Democrats together, right? Those are the arguments for Joe Manchin and Heidi Heitkamp, who, Joe Donnelly, right? People who are in danger of defecting if Kavanaugh, were to perform really well, which obviously he is not in these hearings. My question is that enough to flip a Susan Collins, right? And so I'm trying to think about how do you aim the most pressure at moderate, quote unquote, moderate Republicans. I will also add, we said this in the Q&A, but I'll say it on the main show too. I have just started reading an article. It's by Joseph Fishkin and David Posen, April 2018, Columbia Law Review article. It's called Asymmetric Constitutional Hardball. And they have done research about what they call constitutional hardball, right? So stealing Merrick Garland's seat, constitutional hardball, engaged in by the Republicans. On the other hand, using the nuclear option to confirm Obama justices, they consider constitutional hardball on the left, right? And they define it basically as something that is legal but violates longstanding norms for partisan reasons. And the thesis of the article is that has been far more, the reason it's asymmetric is that the right has been far more active in constitutional hardball tactics than the left. And then they have a recommendation section in which they evaluate between whether the response is the left should play more constitutional hardball or whether that just spirals things out of control, right? Whether once this happens, there's no positive thing you can do, but continuing to play constitutional hardball makes it even worse. I got to dig into the literature and their research methods, but it's on the whiteboard, and I find that super interesting. That applies, I think, to sort of this larger question about strategy. But going back to Kavanaugh and the emails, these series of emails come at a time in which Brett Kavanaugh was a White House staffer and George W. Bush was attempting, ultimately successfully after a convoluted path, to get Priscilla Owen appointed to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And Priscilla Owen was a Texas Supreme Court Republican. She is a member of the Federalist Society. The Republicans were informed by Democrats that they would filibuster her nomination because, she was perceived as being too conservative. And so Brett Kavanaugh is describing how to get Owen on the court. And the first email that I want to link in the show notes and talk about is totally straightforward. And again, I think illustrates my argument that Kavanaugh is a partisan hack and not an impartial guy. And he's this is why I think this will stick, but we'll find out if it sticks enough. So at the time, then Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson from Texas was in charge of introducing Priscilla Owen around to Democratic senators on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And so the initial email to Kavanaugh is, hey, Senator Hutchinson is taking Owen to meet with Senator Dianne Feinstein and Senator Herb Kohl from Wisconsin tomorrow. Hutchinson's office wants to know if there are any subjects we do not want Owen to talk about at these meetings. What do you suggest we tell them? Okay. And here's Kavanaugh's answer. He says, She should not talk about her views on specific policy or legal issues. She should say that she has a commitment to follow Supreme Court precedent, that she understands and appreciates the role of a circuit judge, that she will adhere to statutory text, that she has no ideological agenda. She should probably deal with the contributions issue, emphasizing the themes that were in Judge Gonzalez's letter. Leave aside that last sentence. That's a rabbit trail we're not going to go down. But here you see Kavanaugh directly scripting the answer of, oh, look, we've got this hardcore ideological conservative. She's going to meet with these liberal Democrats. What should she say? Is there anything she shouldn't talk about? And Kavanaugh's answer is, yeah. She just say, you know, this nonsense about how
Furthermore, pretend you don't know the definition of basic words or the names of people that are in the news every day.
Yeah. So I think that looks bad. I don't think that standing alone is going to move the needle. I think there is, and again, I don't want to say a huge probability here. I think there is a probability that this next set of emails may move the needle. And let me kind of set it up. And this is a long email chain, so you start at the bottom, right? And this is the strategy being cooked up in the George W. Bush White House to get support for Judge Owen on the Fifth Circuit. And the subject line is pro-choice op-eds in support of Justice Owen. And so the first staffer, and this person's name is blacked out, says, I learned late Friday that although high-profile pro-choice women such as Ann Stone, Victoria Townsend, and former members of Congress Susan Molinari and Tilly Fowler may be willing to publish op-eds supporting Justice Owen's confirmation, apparently no one has yet signed up to help write them. I presume that such op-eds would be very helpful in this Thursday's meeting as the meeting on Justice Owen approaches. Accordingly, please find two op-eds that I drafted relatively quickly. The first draft is a more political piece, perhaps more appropriate to someone like Molinari. Susan Molinari was a Republican congresswoman from New York who was, somewhat pro-choice. The second draft is geared more specifically for someone like Ann Stone, right, a legal theorist. Then you go through, and then there are these little draft op-eds that the staffer has written to, you know, put in the mouth of a prominent Republican woman to endorse Priscilla Owen. And they say things like the first one talks about, you know, how Democrats are ignoring the fact that George W. Bush has put, you know, women on various courts of appeal and that sort of thing. And then we come to that Priscilla Owen would jeopardize a woman's right to choose. And the email says, the invented charge against Owen is similarly groundless. Some Democrats claim that confirming Owen would somehow threaten a woman's right to choose an abortion. As a fervently pro-choice woman who has studied the law and Owen's 9-year record on the Texas Supreme Court, I find this claim patently absurd. First of all, it is widely accepted by legal scholars across the board that Roe v. Wade and its progeny are settled law of the land. Moreover, federal courts of appeals, which are inferior to the Supreme Court, have no power to overturn Supreme Court precedents like Roe v. Wade, blah, 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 blah. That's the key part of the argument. Then there's a, you know, later bit on Owen herself. Brett Kavanaugh was then asked to weigh in on this memorandum. And here's what he said. And so there's some colloquy back and forth. And then another staffer says, thanks, Brett. I assume you didn't find anything substantively problematic with the op-ed, right? And then Kavanaugh writes back, on substance, I have a few thoughts. First, I think it very odd to compare Owen to Souter and thereby imply that she is another suitor or would be another suitor on the U.S. Supreme Court. That was from that first email talking about the political implications. And here you can see Kavanaugh really having his ear to the ground of knowing that the hard right thinks that David Souter is the biggest mistake that Republicans have ever made. So, that's his sympathy. That's not going to garner much attention. Then he says, I'm not sure the woman point works all that well, and I actually doubt that it is the Democrats' real motivation here, as you say in the last paragraph, blah, blah, blah. Then he says, I am not sure that all legal scholars refer to Roe as the settled law of the land at the Supreme Court level, since court can always overrule its precedent, and three current justices on the court would do so. The point therein is the inferior court point. I think that qualifies as a bombshell in the email. I think it qualifies in two ways, right? Number one, it shows, because the three justices that
yeah,
that
who
he's
are the three
about,
at, the, at this time?
Right. So the three justices that he's clearly thinking of at the time are Scalia, Rehnquist, and Thomas, right? This is right. before you had any Bush appointees. This is in 2003. That's his assessment of the court. Then that obviously translates into his belief that there are four justices on the Supreme Court ready to overrule Roe v. Wade. Now, if there were three justices in 2003, you cannot possibly say, oh, well, I think the Supreme Court is clearly tilted left since 2003. Right. That's a preposterous statement. And it shows that he is acutely aware of the political implications of each and every appointee, and in particular his appointment sitting right now. We got asked the question. I want to make sure that we don't overplay this. William Jackson on Twitter asks us, did he just commit perjury? And shows the headline where Kavanaugh. The headline says, Kavanaugh denies he suggested Roe not settled. Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh is denying that he once suggested the 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling on abortion rights isn't settled law. I don't think you could make a perjury case on that. I think you could make the case of, look, here's what Kavanaugh has done, right? And this is what he said to Susan Collins and what enabled Susan Collins to come out and say, I'm inclined to support Brett Kavanaugh. He said, Roe v. Wade is settled law. That's true, right? But what he was doing, right, the game he's playing on that is, .. but I don't give a damn about settled law because all I care about is originalism, and we can overturn precedent as we demonstrated in the Janus versus Abood case. In the Janus case overruling Abood whenever we don't like the result. And so saying something is settled law means nothing.
Well, it's meaningless
to somebody
if his definition is, well, that a court can just overturn it. Well, yeah, that's everything, though. Like a court can overturn everything.
That is exactly. I mean, like, and so what we see here is really giving away the game and pulling back the curtain. This is, I intend to use this in every discussion I have with somebody who argues for originalism from this point forward, right? Brett Kavanaugh says, I'm not sure that the X case is settled law of the land at the Supreme Court level, since the court can always overrule its precedent. And by the way, we happen to know that there are judges on the bench itching to do so. I think that's significant. And again, I'm a jurisprudence geek, so you know, maybe this lands with a thud. Maybe you know, Mainers don't care. But I think Susan Collins has behaved as though the fig leaf of impartiality is important. And I would certainly, if I were the Democrats, these are the questions that I would be asking in my 5 minutes, right? Let's talk about, you know, let's drill down. When you said the Supreme Court can always overrule its precedent. So in your view, as somebody who's about to sit on the Supreme Court, what is settled law at the Supreme Court level? Is it just whatever you think it is?
Settled law, you're asking? Time's up, right?
Time is up on my five minutes, right?
Why do we even have these
as
hearings?
You illustrate,
gosh.
Yeah. I think, look, as that continues, right, if he continues to sort of filibuster, used in the colloquial term here, right, if he continues to talk without saying anything, and, you know, you're left at the end of the hearings with a nominee who didn't answer questions and for whom hundreds of thousands of pages of documents like this were not produced, you know, is that going to be a salient argument to Collins? I don't know. I wouldn't bet more likely than not, but I'm not sure. I wouldn't bet that it definitely is, but I wouldn't bet that it's a zero. I think this moves the needle. I don't know. I wouldn't bet that it moves it enough, but I think it does move the needle.
And it's kind of, you know, going back to the discussion we were having earlier, it is always a question of which argument are you making and to whom? You know, like if the argument is how do we get, you know, Collins to maybe flip a vote, then yeah, that's going to be one set of arguments. If this was Space Court, and we're arguing just like the overall merits of what's happening in Space Court or something to an alien deity. That always happens on Star Trek. There's always some weird alien like God thing, and then you got to order and argue in Space Court. I would say, well, there's many reasons. Mainly, they stole a seat, and also the president is under investigation. But I get that that wouldn't be necessarily as effective with a Republican. But what I want to say, I just got to take a second to say thank you, Cory Booker, for finally fighting in a way that is equivalent to what Republicans are doing. I don't know if you're going to agree with me on this, Andrew, but I don't know how people feel about Booker. I know some people seem to not like him on the left. I don't know why, but I've always liked him. But I guess there was the pharmaceutical bill and stuff like that. People are concerned about his money he's taken from pharmaceutical companies. But I just have to say, this is the way you fight like a Republican, by releasing these emails that are, you know, secret. Oh no, we can't release these. And then the guy's like, well, you might face expulsion from the Senate. And he's like, okay, whatever. You're not going to do that. I think you need, now, quick legal question. I believe the supposed consequences for Booker doing this are expulsion from the Senate, but you would probably need 67 votes on that, right?
Yes. You need it to even be censured in the Senate. You need a vote of 2/3 of the Senate.
Okay. So here's what we do. Completely F all of these stupid rules. Just who cares? Going back to your hardball thing, I think in this circumstance where they are hiding documents and not releasing documents, people like Booker are, I think he did the perfect right thing. And he finally, maybe he'll inspire Democrats to actually fight in a way that's going to do anything, is to say, oh, wait, this norm where we don't do this, this is only enforced by 67 vote thing, which isn't going to happen because, you know, at best Republicans could get 52 or whatever it is. So screw those rules. I'll just release all this stuff to the media and done deal. Now, I don't know if maybe he can be kicked out of like the specific Senate subcommittee. Maybe, I don't know. But still, it seems worthwhile to me. Like there's no consequences for this. We found a norm that we can break, and get away with it. And I think it might serve a good function here. So what do you think about all that? Am I nuts?
No, I don't think you're nuts. I have the reservations that I always have. I think there is historical precedent here, right? So that we've talked about this before, but Joe Biden was the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee in 1986 when the Senate Judiciary Committee decided they were going to take on President Reagan's efforts to put Robert Bork on the Supreme Court. And we have talked about that from a historical perspective and Republican historical revisionism and Bork being used as a verb and the idea that they were somehow unfair. At the time, that was what catapulted Joe Biden into eventually front runner status for the Democratic nomination in 1988. Had he not done that, he would not have been able to run for president in 1988. It built his reputation in the Democratic Party as, you know, this young up and comer and the guy we want to be our nominee. And then he was taken down. We've talked about this before by, you know, what I think is a highly misleading but very effective Michael Dukakis attack ad put together by John Sasso. So all of that is to say, Cory Booker, who has not specifically announced that he is running for president in 2020, I believe, but who certainly is, I think I own in our Democrat fantasy football league.
I can't wait to get back to that. That'll be fun.
This could very well be very good for him politically, and I wouldn't be surprised if it were. And so, you know, that in my mind, that is kind of the other side. When you say fight like a Republican, right? Part of what has driven the Republican Party to these kinds of extremes is the fact that they pay no consequence in the general election, and it's sort of a race to the right in primaries. And you know, there may be some symmetry there, particularly in 2020. So that's, I think if you...
And
if,
you know what, a bit with regarding this norm, this is something that I actually don't mind if it went away. Like if the deal is, okay, well, next time there's a liberal nominee And they have some really cagey, damning emails that liberals were going to try to hide. And then it turns out they can't. I'm like, okay, well, that's, I don't, okay. It's like, same thing when people say like, oh, this Russia investigation is going to topple a few Democrats too, so you better not do it. It's like, no, that's fine. Topple all the corrupt people. That's fine. Right, I don't care.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. So,
hey, folks, need to cut in to tell you about our sponsor, Vistaprint. Not sure if you know this about me, but I have a podcast or two, and I also attend conferences, conventions, that kind of thing. And there are all kinds of people who I might want to network with, and I do try to maybe interview or form a professional relationship with. The way to help make those connections and also let people know that you're someone to be taken seriously and someone who is professional is to have a nice business card to hand them. And Vistaprint is a great way to make that happen. The difference between making that connection and not could be huge, but the price to be ready for all of that is $10. Because Vistaprint can give you that confidence to be ready to make an impression. Because you can get a custom card with the colors, the fonts, and the designs, and the images you choose. All for $10. With Vistaprint, you can create a truly professional, unique card in minutes. Upload your own design or start with one of the professionally designed options that Vistaprint offers. And they also have simple tools and a wide range of templates to choose from. Pick the paper stock, style, and the quantity that's right for you. You also choose your delivery speed, order and receive your cards in as few as 3 days. Vistaprint uses only carefully selected inks and responsibly sourced paper stocks. They have dozens of designs that are just right for your business. Add your logo, contact information with just a few clicks, and know you can use it all in your marketing going forward. Your satisfaction is 100% guaranteed, or they'll make it right, either by reprinting your order or offering a refund. Vistaprint wants you to do something great for your business right now, which is why our listeners will get 500 high-quality custom business cards starting at $9.99. Use code OA at Vistaprint.com. That's code OA at Vistaprint.com. One more time, OA at Vistaprint.com. Make it happen. All right. Well, man, I know there's more we could talk about, but we had another... We had another segment to get to, so I think we'll have to pause there, even though there's, you know, we didn't even talk about the anonymous, stupid op-ed about how someone's secretly actually working behind the scenes to help everybody with Trump. Well, I think we'll get to that eventually, but I just don't think we have time today.
Yeah, look, we'll know by the time episode 208 airs. Right. We'll know if any of this matters. Right. So and believe me, if it does matter and matter could be defined as just convincing Susan Collins to vote to extend the timing of the Kavanaugh hearing. Right. Like, I mean, anything other than the hearings are over and we're headed to a vote is a win at this point for Democrats. Right. So we'll know that next week. And believe me, if there's even a modest win on the horizon, you can bet we'll cover it.
And Andrew, as we were editing this show, just to cut in a quick note, looks like there might be a bombshell-y thing happening with Kavanaugh. What do you think?
Yeah, we just received, and I mean, after recording this episode, we are re-recording and splicing this back in. You and I have had 5 minutes to look at this. So it, all of those caveats that apply. Here's what has been released. The first, it's a juxtaposition. We tweeted this out on the opening arguments Twitter feed, but lots of our listeners don't follow us on Twitter. And if not, why not?
For some reason. Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah, who knows? It's at Open Args. So here's what has just been discovered. Brett Kavanaugh obviously was confirmed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. And at that time, he had to be confirmed by the Senate. And he was questioned by the Senate Judiciary Committee at the time regarding his tenure in the Bush White House. And in particular, he was asked a series of questions related to whether he had any role in the nomination of William Pryor to the 11th Circuit. And this is somebody, Thomas, you and I talked about way back on our first Kavanaugh episode, as if Trump wanted to pick a trigger the libs nominee, he would go with William Pryor. This is somebody who was called Roe versus Wade an abomination of constitutional law and the worst decision, you know, of all time, right? It would have gotten no additional merit in terms of actually getting someone more conservative on the Supreme Court, because Brett Kavanaugh shares those views. But he's less politic about it. He is more bombastic. Brett Kavanaugh has prepared his entire lifetime to be on the Supreme Court, and it shows. So that's the context. Kavanaugh is being questioned by Ted Kennedy about William Pryor, and Kavanaugh has very clearly said, I had nothing to do with the Pryor nomination. And Kennedy's questions are, look, why didn't you speak up against this extremist inside? That's the context of the questions. And so in that context, Kennedy asks, here you've got, you're talking here about background discussions. Once you have the nominee, you're involved in the process where he calls a case the worst abomination of constitutional law in our history, criticizes Miranda, right, that the Miranda rights, and refers to the Supreme Court as nine octogenarian lawyers. You're involved in the vetting process. Whether you did anything at all about it, I gather you say you did not. And Kavanaugh's answer is, no, I was not involved in handling his nomination, right? And then there's a further follow-up question, right? Senator Kennedy, and this is, again, good lawyering here. So you weren't involved in any of the vetting, as I understand it, of Mr. Pryor. Is that right, Mr. Kavanaugh? No. I know him and I have met him before, but it wasn't one of the way the work is divvied up. That wasn't one of the ones I, and then he's cut off as Ted Kennedy asks another question. Did you know about his involvement? But you see, the questions here are broad, and Brett Kavanaugh's answer is an unequivocal denial. I was not involved in handling the nomination. I didn't do anything in the vetting process. I was not involved in any of the vetting. No. That is juxtaposed with an email that was released dated June 5th, 2003. Subject line, emergency umbrella meeting tomorrow, on which Brett Kavanaugh is BCC'd. Okay? And it says, there will be an emergency umbrella meeting tomorrow at 2:30. At the law firm of Baker and Hostetler, we need to discuss nominee Bill Pryor's hearing next Wednesday, and there are important confirmation process issues with Judge Kuhl that need to be addressed. So, what could Brett Kavanaugh say about this? He could say, I was BCC, I was, you know, I didn't have anything. He can say that, but nevertheless, he was kept in the loop on the vetting process. And that seems to be dishonest at minimum. And it strongly suggests the argument that I would make. And again, the question here is how much do we move the needle? And the argument I would make is this is why we need to get all of Kavanaugh's documents, because he was BCC'd on this one. If his answer is going to be, oh, this is one on which I was BCC'd, come on, then I think it's a really persuasive argument. And it's a persuasive argument with Republicans, with anybody of, okay, the judge has said just the one. Right. I was random. Sorry, they made a mistake. I was BCC'd on it. It didn't happen. Okay, so let's see all the documents. Let's see if that is correct. We want to give you the benefit of the doubt. We're not saying it's perjury. We're not saying you lied. Could be, right? If it's a total honest mistake, then let's look at all of it. But we cannot evaluate this statement without evaluating all of your documents. That's where I would go.
But still, this is weird. Why is this testimony coming out? Couldn't somebody have asked him, could somebody question him about this right now?
Yes, absolutely. The with the remaining time that Democrats have, they absolutely should question Judge Kavanaugh about this.
All right. Well, there you have it. That's a real rapid response, but we'll keep an eye on it. Just wanted to get that in there.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook.
Nobody, so you're not aware of any context during the course of the election?
How many times do I have to answer this question?
Can you just say
Russia
yes or no
is
on
a
it?
Ruse? Yeah, I know you have to get up and ask a question, so important. Russia is a ruse.
Well, I'm not a crook.
All All right. Well, it is time to move over to a quick jaunt to Yodel Mountain. What's going on? Is Manafort update? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah. So two critical pieces of information. The developments in the Manafort case, right? This is the D.C. case before Judge Jackson. We talked about how Paul Manafort had filed the same motions that he had filed in the Eastern District of Virginia case. And they have reached the same result. So it's not at all surprising. But the New York Times ran like this kind of weird article on how Judge Jackson granted the defense motion in limine that the government can't talk about the Mueller investigation during the Manafort trial, which, again, same argument made and granted with minimal opposition on only, you know, one point as in the Eastern District of Virginia case. So if you saw that, and a couple people did and emailed in and said, hey, what's going on? Is this, you know, potentially good news for Paul Manafort or what? No. Right. And it was shocking to see that coming out of the New York Times. I expected it out of, you know, Fox News, but no. And if you want to read even more into it, I would say, if I were asked to read the tea leaves, this is another thing. We've talked about how judges bulletproof their opinions. And this is another way of bulletproofing your opinion, right? Of saying, hey, look, we want to make sure that there are absolutely no grounds for Manafort to get this conviction reversed on appeal. And so, yeah, yep, he said this is potentially prejudicial. Yep, let's grant the motion in limine. Take that argument away from him. The second development here on Yodel Mountain is the plea agreement with Sam Patton, W. Samuel Patton, on violations of the Foreign Agents Registration Act. And this is significant. I'm going to link the documents in the show notes because this starts to show how Mueller is connecting up the dots between Manafort, where, you know, as we've said, you know, we just said in the first sub part of the segment, Manafort directly is not tied for the actions for which he was convicted and for which he will be convicted in D.C. to the Trump campaign. This is starting to put the dots together. So what did Patton do? Patton worked with Foreigner A, a Russian national, that is Konstantin Kalimnik. He is not identified as such in the document, of course. And the two of them formed a company in the United States called Company A. We're 50-50 partners. They advised the opposition bloc, the pro-Russian Ukrainian political party, and members of that party, including a prominent Ukrainian oligarch, on political consulting services involving work within the Ukraine as well as lobbying in the United States. Did not disclose that, did not register under FARA in the U.S. What Patton did was coordinate meetings between this high-level Ukrainian oligarch, right? That is the eventual pro-Russian, now treasonous ex-president of Ukraine, and A, members of Congress and their staff, specifically senators on the Foreign Relations Committee and representatives on the House Committee on Foreign Affairs, and B, the executive branch, including officials from the U.S. Department of State, and C, numerous members of the U.S. media. Okay, so that's really bad. Then what it includes is an admission that what Patton did was coordinate the ability for these foreign nationals, including Kalimnik, to attend the Trump inauguration. And it specifically says he used a straw purchaser as a United States citizen to pay $50,000 for four tickets to the inauguration. And then Patton paid them the $50,000, and then he took those two foreigners and, probably a hooker.
$50,000. Right? I've seen the pictures. It's not like there are that many people at the inauguration.
Right. And look, again, it is a crime for for the presidential inauguration committee to receive funds from foreign nationals for obvious reasons. So he was the go-between between the Ukrainians and the Trump administration. And by itself, is this a huge deal? It is absolutely not a huge deal. But this is sort of the one of the first links in the chain of, you know, you have already seen the president and you have seen the Republican Party line being, oh, well, you know, this is just Manafort just happened to work for the pro-Russian leader of the Ukraine. But all of that was, you know, several months before he was Donald Trump's campaign chair. So, you know, there's no connection whatsoever. This is Mueller starting to build that connection. This guy has pled and flipped and is cooperating. And if past is prologue, I think we're going to continue to see these links in the chain be filled out, the connect up, the illegal behavior to specifically to the Trump campaign and then the Trump administration. I should add, in addition, Patton pled guilty to misleading the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Remember, that is the investigation we have talked about, chaired by Richard Burr, into the Russian interference with the 2016 election. So this is also the first connection we have between the types of crimes that have been committed for which we have either criminal guilty verdicts in the case of Paul Manafort or guilty plea bargains in the case of everybody else. This connects that up with the Senate intelligence report on the 2016 election on Russian interference to undermine the U.S. election. So kind of flew under the radar, but I think this is a big thing.
Kidding.
And that's why we're yodeling.
If you were wondering why we were yodeling, that is why. And just a quick patron comment as well from
Buck Buckholz.
Hey guys, love the show. Concerning Manafort's change of venue request, it is true that the jury would be taken from Roanoke County, which is definitely Trump territory. However, as a proud citizen of Roanoke City, I would like to make it clear that the city is very blue, surrounded by a sea of red. You have several listener supporters here in Roanoke City, and we don't want to be labeled as a hotbed of MAGAs. Love you guys. Oh, thank you, Buck. Yep. No, sure. I mean, I assume that about virtually every city of any size, you know. That's usually how it works. It's like cities blue, everything else red.
Yeah. Where do people live?
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, even when I drive,
no, even when I drive 25 minutes into the, you know, into the foothills of California, it's MAGA. You know, it's like it's weird. You know, it's not people think of California as like, oh, blue state. And it's like, no, the cities are gigantic population centers of liberals. And then there's a bunch of conservatives everywhere else. But anyway, thanks for the comment. We appreciate it. And sure, we let it be stated for the record that Roanoke City is a blue city. All right, well.
So mote it be.
Yeah. Oh, man, so much we couldn't get to. But, you know, we'll get there eventually. That's the nature of being human beings and not having infinite time. But now we are going to go to thank our top patrons at patreon.com/law, who I'm sure are enjoying a very long Law Awful Movies. We put a lot of time and effort into that one because this movie, The Rainmaker from 1997... You might think back, you know, if you're me, I was like 11 or something, but you might think back and think, oh, that sounded like a serious movie. You know, it's Francis Ford Coppola. It's, you know, it's Matt Damon's first ever role, right? Major role.
Yep.
And it's got Danny DeVito. It's got all kinds of actors in it. You might think, oh yeah, that was a prestigious legal drama, but, you'd be wrong. Andrew and I went back, and it's a steaming pile, this movie, and it's embarrassingly bad. Tune in to Law Awful Movies to find out whether it was among the worst legal movies we've ever done, law wise. It's out there. All right. So, top patrons
and we have watched Jury Duty, so yeah. Keep that in mind that our bar is not high for this.
Yeah, exactly. Or it's very high, I guess, for the worst. But yeah, our patrons, our top patrons who are enjoying that Law Awful Movies, maybe as we speak, Our wordorigins.org, your guide to legal terms from 13th century Saxony. This Week in News with Kevin and Benedict. The other Michael Cohen. Oh, man, I'm sorry. Sagashite Fukusumi, grape or grain, but never the twain. Rob Schreck, Poseidon is 9/10 of maritime law. It always gets me. Mike the Intactivist, Matthew Vernon, Japan Dan, in bed with Eli.
Hey, welcome back, Japan Dan, too, by the way.
Yeah, and I don't think that's Anna, so we got some breaking tabloid news here. I listened to OA at the direction of the candidate. Getting off podcast. Future Yodel Mountain Fantasy Football Champion Joe Boo's rum. we'll see. Forcing bakers to meditate is unconstitutional because meditation is gay. Huh. Forcing bakers to meditate. I hope that's, I don't get it, but that's fine. Dalen Lee Samus Grix. Anonymous. All Trump's family and friends are crooks. No, it is Dr. What is this, a reference that I don't know? It is Dr. Bergiers. Is that a?
I don't get that one either. I thought it was going to be
It's like a Hitchhiker's reference. I don't get.
Yeah.
Join your labor union. Notus gratis potus chosus bogus scotus zealots. I don't advocate violence, but Senator Graham has a punchable face. True. Healing Elementals on Etsy. Promo code OpenArgs for 10% off. Don't pardon me, I'll pardon myself. A string of unpronounceable characters. Livebaseballscorecards.com. Oh, interesting. Yodel Mountain Unitary Executive Defense Force. We know about your clever hack. It's called fraud. Using my wife's Patreon to make Andrew say things since episode 186. I love it. Unnamed senior administration official. Yeah, there you go. Someone got it in. Wow, that was quick. Thomas was right. Mike Peterson didn't do it. Ooh, thank you. Thank you very much. The Wayward Willis podcast, still celebrating the engagement. We are too. Congratulations. Starry Decisis from the top rope, brother. So good. Squidfinger, Soul, Soggy Pants, savor the bright orange zest of Yodel Mountain Vineyard, mana fortified wine. Sam Danau, Sam, St. Muller, patron saint of yodelers, Ryan Null, Rhonda the Rigged Witch Hunter, Patreon goal, Andrew Cooking Special. Oh, we got to get back to that. That'd
ooh,
be good.
Yeah, I would do that.
Old Man Manafort, home country, Old Man Manafort's home country polonium tea. Nooners, Spooners, and Hot Air Ballooners LLP. Woo, all right, great names, and your turn, Andrew.
Yeah, thank you too. Milo Meadsong, the Halfling Bard, and SIU 3L. Malika Chandler, Legalize the Purge, Kurt Robinson, Kiowa Valley Exports for Australian Red Meat and Craft Beer. Oh, that sounds delicious. Keith Davies, Jordan B. Peters' son, not Jordan B. Peterson. Hey, Jordan B. Peterson ought to throw us a couple bucks. I mean, he's getting $1 million on Patreon.
Yeah.
Jim Grove, in the real universe, President Hillary Clinton nominated Barack Obama. Impeach the MFR already, itmfa.org. That is the who's his name?
Ash Lux.
Yeah, Dan Savage, right? Yeah, that is Dan Savage's charity. In an alley, hopefully it's Dan Savage as a patron. Hey Dan, give us a call. Yeah. I'm not creative enough to increase my pledge for Philosophers in Space. I will never watch Food Network the same way again. Yeah, I'm telling you, if you are a Food Network watcher, you gotta listen to the awful movies to the first 5 minutes. There's an important Food Network bit there. Hot spots on my dog, Greg Sullivan, Eli Bosnick, David Satz, Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense, Cooking Heath with Ramen, Cherith Cute Story, Maritime Lawyer, CampQuest.org, CampQuest.org, CampQuest.org. Buttercup's Polyphony Services, Actual Yodeling Advice from an Actual Cat, Brian Upshaw's Last Chance for Profit Prison, Blank Boxman, Andrew, Do a Lamb on Tickled and its follow-up, both on Hulu.
Hulu,
Big Easy Blasphemy, another Two Live Crew reference, Andrew's third grade teacher, Judy Cheek, says to say hi. Oh my gosh. That is actually my third grade teacher.
Wow.
I remember her fondly, and wow, I have no idea who that patron is.
Well,
but,
it looks like maybe the patron's not Judy Cheek, but maybe it's somebody who ran into Judy Cheek. I'm guessing.
Wow. So please.
Where's my,
say
has
hi.
Anybody seen my third grade teacher, Mr. Ingham? Let me know.
All right, please do. Yeah. That's amazing. So hi, Judy, if you're listening, thank you so much for everything you did for me. Adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. Aaron Grady, Open Arg, serving up Mullard wine and cheese since 2016. And that's wine with an H. I love that. The NRA is a terrorist organization. My favorite fish is the Humu Humu Nuku Nuku Apua. Mitchell, Liz put RBG on the blockchain weeks. I'm lowering my SIO pledge every time Thomas criticizes 80s music. Thank you.
Man, it's going to be negative. I'm going to owe you money, I guess.
I, Thomas Smith, will finally watch the Brat Pack canon. That's binding now, by the way, since I said that. Dave, living life Yodel Mountain High in Trump's America. Jeremiah's fancy microwave emporium. Thomas should finish that draft email to Ryan Byrne.
Oh, man. Is somebody in my email? Because that's totally true. Okay.
Treason with an exclamation point. And of course, as always, our top patron, our number one, the greatest of all time, Conrad Michaels.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to beat Conrad Michaels. I'm rooting for you to try, but I don't think you're going to. Thanks, Conrad.
Every good champion needs a number one contender, needs a challenger. Yeah. So yeah, true. Get in there.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Really, we love that segment because the names are so funny. And thanks for being patrons. And now it is time to get to TTTB on a bit of a hot streak, although I feel like there's been an accounting error in the questions because I thought I had more to give for 60%, but apparently I only have like two.
Yeah, you've got two more to give, but you're on a big hot streak, and we have another evidence question. So
It's not real property, guys. I have a chance.
you're saying there's a chance. Yeah. All right. At a defendant's trial for gang-related murder, the prosecution introduced, as former testimony, a statement by a gang member who testified against the defendant at a preliminary hearing and has now invoked his privilege against self-incrimination. So this is a totally timely question, too. I'm so excited. If the defendant now seeks to impeach the credibility of the gang member, which of the following is the court most likely to admit? A.
Okay.
Evidence that the gang member had three misdemeanor convictions for assault. B, testimony by a psychologist that persons with the gang member's background have a tendency to fabricate. C, testimony by a witness that at the time the gang member testified, the gang member was challenging the defendant's leadership role in the gang. Or D, testimony by a witness that the gang member is a cocaine dealer.
Well, shoot, this one seems super straightforward to me, but that could always mean I'm way wrong. Okay, most of these seem like not good. So I think I'll just go through them and I think I can eliminate them. A, evidence that the gang member had three misdemeanor convictions for assault. I think we've covered that. I mean, it's a little foggy because it seems like there's some times when you can bring that into evidence like past convictions. But I do remember from the famous bird feeding the birds question, and TTTBE, where they wanted to bring evidence that this person has a misdemeanor for feeding birds or whatever, and it was like, no, this is not relevant. I would say that while assault is bad, I would say it is to be expected that another fellow gang member probably has some convictions for assault. It wouldn't necessarily impeach the credibility of somebody telling the truth, I don't think, and I don't know that it would be allowed. So I don't think it's A. B, testimony by a psychologist that persons with a gang member's background have a tendency to fabricate. Now, that's the worst one. If that's true, I'm going to be very disappointed because that seems completely bogus. But if this is some tricky question where, like, even though that's nonsense, it's allowable by the court, you know, I'll get bit in the butt for that. But I'm going to eliminate B. That seems terrible. And then D is the other one. Testimony by witness that the gang member is a cocaine dealer. Now, again, we're all talking about gang members here. Like, we all know they're gang members. I don't think that, you know, that's to be expected that gang members are doing illicit things. I think C, testimony by a witness that at the time the gang member testified, the gang member was challenging the defendant's leadership role in the gang. I mean, that's the only one that really seems relevant at all to the whether or not this person will be telling the truth. So I'm going to go with C. I think that it's possible this is a trick question where, you know, it's not so much based on what would actually be good evidence to impeach the gang member, but more along the lines of rules of evidence, like what the court will allow. And maybe C will somehow be wrong. But I'm going with C. It seems the most correct to me.
All right. So Thomas out there with a bold statement. And if you'd like to join him in that, or if perhaps you'd like to contradict him, you guys know how to play along. It's super easy. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag TTTB. Include your guests, the reasons therefore, and we will select a winner and shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune, not guaranteed.
All right. Well, thank you for listening. Thank you for the fact that you understand we only have so many hours in a day to do an episode, and there's a lot we couldn't get to today, but there's always more opening arguments to come. So we appreciate you listening. Keep yodeling, everybody, and we'll see you very soon.
See you then.
You betray the law! Law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.